This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Indiana State Senator Eddie Melton. He's back from his term of office at the General Assembly, and we'll talk with him about the issues that came up in the 2018 General Assembly session and a little hint as to what may come up at that special session soon. Also, we'll bring back our conversation with Tammy Silverman of the Indiana Youth Institute on the latest Kids Count data book. And we'll also talk with Todd Zeiger of Indiana Landmarks here in northern Indiana about the May 4th and May 5th events involving the Logs to Lustrons 2018 Talk and Tour. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. State Senator Eddie Melton has another General Assembly session under his belt, so to speak. We asked him to come into the Lakeshore Public Radio studios to talk about the session just ended, about the short special session that's just ahead, and an even further look ahead to the 2019 session. Senator Melton, if you will give us an idea on how things went for this past legislative session.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of share my perspective with your listening audience on how I think this 2018 legislative session went. I definitely agree that with many of the folks that have watched this, this is probably one of the more interesting ones I've seen. Mm-hmm. Definitely by this being my second year as a legislator, some issues that we address from workforce development, identifying some issues that we continuously need to address from education, and so forth, continuously are be at the forefront of the conversations legislatively. But all in all, I think that it was a good session. I think we ended very abruptly, not being able to address some issues, some which I think personally could wait to 2019, and some that can't. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested in seeing how we move forward with this very short session that the governor is calling us back for.
Okay. Some of the measures I know that you worked with your colleagues on in both the House and the Senate, actually, mm-hmm. Were very important. In particular, one of which we had a chance to highlight in a conversation with Senator Ed Charbonneau here not long ago, talking about dealing with the water infrastructure measure, and that was one of these successful ones that made it through.
Yes. Well, I just want to commend all of the hard work that Senator Ed Charbonneau has done when it comes down to addressing our critical water infrastructure issues. Here in alone, just Northwest Indiana, we have a very aged system. I believe a lot of the research and information that he's been able to bring forth to the our fellow senators and to the legislature has been helpful for us to understand the magnitude of this issue. And of course, we address infrastructure from a road standpoint last year. However, our water infrastructure is just as important mm-hmm. To our constituents and to residents and everyone in the state of Indiana. So I think what we've done in terms of creating what that financing structure looks like and how do we create a process where we can fund upgrading our water system is going to be extremely important moving forward.
Okay. You mentioned before here about some of the measures that you were especially pleased to be able to work on in the legislative session, dealt with education. We'll talk specifically here about mm-hmm. an update on the Gary Community Schools in a moment here, but fill us in on the bills that made it through that you were co-sponsor or sponsor of, dealt directly with education.
Well, many of your listening audience may be familiar with some of the lack of strategy when it comes down to workforce development. Mm-hmm. So we have Senate Bill 50, which, in my opinion, is kind of starting the process of how do we better communicate with all of our state institutions or state departments in coordinating efforts in workforce development, be it from high school all the way to some of our more non-traditional students. So Senate Bill 50 was something that I worked with Senator Doug Eckerty on. I believe we have a long way to go to create a more robust workforce development plan, but I think we got off to a good start. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 189 is something I worked with Senator Ryan Mishler on. He's the chairman of Appropriations, and there was a short funding gap this year in terms of funding public education. There were more students that enrolled that the state anticipated in public schools across the state of Indiana, and I believe we were short several millions of dollars to ensure that all of our public schools had the support and resources needed to make that happen. Then there are other bills, and I don't have those exact bill numbers in front of me, that we address early childhood education, which is going to continuously be an ongoing subject matter and discussion. We're in dialogue and discussion about how do we address the teacher shortage, looking at it from a very different way and perspective, at the quality of the test, to ensure that there's a very valid test that's not preventing quality educators from entering to this workforce.
I know there was one measure that you had worked with your colleagues on involving high school diplomas, among other issues.
Yes.
Tell us about that one and how things went with that.
Well, with the ESSA, which is the federal regulations around Every Student Succeeds Act, that's what it's called, there were some things that we as a state had to do to make sure we were in compliance with federal regulations. And part of that, there was a lot of controversy and conversations with the State Board of Education on some of the policies they had designed around the high school diploma. So I think we were able to address a lot of the issues that some of the higher ed institutions, as well as our local instructors, our local school leaders, superintendents and professions, to address making sure we have a clear, concise path when it comes down to high school graduation, what the diploma looks like.
Mm-hmm. You have also put out recently a guest commentary in the Times talking about how students should be ready for the future, and a lot of that has to do with getting the right education, and that comes, in part as well, too, on some of the efforts that they're being done at the State House on workforce development, that too, I understand.
Yeah, I think we have to approach this holistically. And we can't approach this in a fragmented way. From early childhood education to ensuring that all our schools have the resources needed, because education, the face of education, funding education has changed over the years. We have so many different methods, so many different types of schools. We have innovation networks. We have transformation zones. We have traditional public education, we have charter schools, and it continues to evolve. And I believe that we have to be very cautious as we think about what we want public education to provide our students and how we want it to look in the future, and how we fund it and support it. But as we look at, as those students matriculate or transfer out of or graduate out of high school, you know, what are their next steps? What are their options? And we have to look at that as a region. We have to look at that as a state, as what are their options? How do we, you know, Lake County has a huge population loss that's occurred since the 70s.
Right.
You know, how do we address that in terms of making it attractive for students and young adults to stay in Northwest Indiana? And I say young adults, I'm talking about those that are at Ivy Tech, IUN, Purdue, Valpo, at our higher institutions in Northwest Indiana. How do we make it more attractive for them to stay, but also how do we make it more attractive and invite folks that do not live in our communities and make it inviting and welcoming for them as well to look at us as an option?
Okay. We're talking with State Senator Eddie Melton about some of the issues that have come up in the 2018 General Assembly session. It's finished. And one of the issues I know that had been reviewed, and you've signed on as a co-sponsor on a companion bill in the Senate, unfortunately didn't make it this time around. It's the measure that the city of Gary was most concerned about, dealing with the construction and demolition waste that will come about with more homes and structures being demolished. And I know that State Representative Earl Harris sponsored the bill, had a lot of support from all of the members, I guess, pretty much of the Lake County delegation on this. And you went and carried it on into the Senate, but it suddenly died. And if you will, fill us in on that. And do you think that maybe the measure, because I know there's a certain sense of urgency behind it, that we may come back up in 2019?
Well, just to kind of clarify a little bit about that, I did become a co-sponsor for that bill. Myself and the other Northwest Indiana or Gary delegation differed in our thought about the legislation. And I shared that with them. I shared that with the mayor. And I just had a few concerns that were expressed in the community. I think that we needed to vet it a little bit more closely before we move forward in passing that legislation. So after talking with the chairman of the Environmental Committee in the Senate, that was Senator Doug Eckerty, he agreed not to hear the bill. And I agree with you. Let me kind of back up and make this statement and let folks know. I, without a shadow of a doubt, know that as a resident of Gary and as someone that was born and raised in Gary, know we have a blight issue. But how we go about addressing that blight issue, I think we have to be a little bit more inclusive and including the community on how we do that. When we look at the construction and demolition site that was being proposed, the specific legislation raised some questions in terms of the proximity to residential facilities. So I think working with the mayor, working with the legislators, my colleagues in the House, hopefully we will be able to come to some type of understanding on how to best address the blight issue and utilizing our federal resources more efficiently and effectively.
So do you think that there's a possibility that maybe this measure could come up in 2019 if it's been revised and maybe is properly tailored for the community?
Well, I've learned that you can never say.
You just never know. I know.
You never know dealing with the legislature, but yeah. I'm optimistic that we're all willing to work together to fix this issue.
Okay. One of the other issues, and we know that you're the principal sponsor on that, actually got to see it become enacted into law, is dealing with the state takeover of the Gary Community School Corporation and the problems financially and academically that the school district has. And I know that you've had some concerns here, although I'm sure you feel that that Dr. Peggy Hinckley, who's the emergency manager, is doing, and her team members, I should say, are doing a good job in dealing with the problems with the Gary schools. But you have some concerns, and I know that you've voiced them about what's come out here. In particular, I know about whether, I guess, the emergency manager has the authority to take a step forward, maybe, and names of members of the school board and like. Tell us about that, and do you think this is going to have any kind of impact in what could become future legislation?
Yeah, I definitely agree that we have to be very cautious on how we empower state entities or state-appointed entities in dealing with local governing bodies. For example, you mentioned earlier about last year's legislation, Senate Bill 567, which was a state takeover of the school corporation. Well, that was something that we had to do to ensure that the district stayed intact and functioning from a fiscal standpoint with over $100 million of debt, and it was still compounding at that particular point. So I definitely want to commend Dr. Hinckley and her team on the hard work and the very tough and difficult decisions they have to make day in and day out when it comes down to the financial management, when it comes down to the academic sustainability of the district as well. The House Bill 1315 was giving the emergency manager the authority to select the board members if they were vacant. Currently, our Gary School Board is an elected body. The current statute, which allows the current governing body, if there is a vacancy, and there is a vacancy right now, that governing body should have an opportunity to select someone in the community to represent that seat, to replace that seat, and to select them as their, they should be able to select their leadership, be it the president, vice president, et cetera. Now, this board has absolutely no fiscal authority. They have no governing authority. So at this point, I think one of the things I wanted to communicate to the legislature was that we have to respect the institution of the electoral process. And although this body does not have the authority to make decisions, they were elected to represent a constituency. And I believe that we should continue to respect that process as we go through these changes in the district.
Mm-hmm. finishing up this legislative session, we happen to see the leaving of office of some very key people in Northwest Indiana who've served the legislature well over the mm-hmm. decades. People like State Representative Charlie Brown, State Representative Scott Pilath in particular, his leadership roles, and Linda Lawson, of course, yeah. from Hammond. What are your thoughts on losing this great drain of institutional wealth that is leaving the legislature?
Right. Well, first off, let me just say each individual that you just mentioned have contributed so much to not just the state of Indiana, but also Northwest Indiana. So I want to thank them publicly for their service in the legislature. I see this as an opportunity. I see this as an opportunity not just locally, but how do we address some of the new issues that are arising to the legislature. And bringing in folks that are willing to tackle those issues, being inclusive in a local level and working with the community and stakeholders to get more engaged on a policy-making process that impacts the lives of all residents in Lake County, Northwest Indiana, and throughout the state. So although it is a loss, I do see it as an opportunity for us to find leaders that can try their best to represent the constituents, to have an opportunity to elect them.
And finally, Senator Melton, looking ahead into 2019, we've mm-hmm. talked about a number of bills and things that may possibly come back up in future legislation. Have you thought about anything in particular that you might bring up in the next session?
Yeah, I'll be focusing on the Department of Child Services. Of course, there are some issues that have come up and allegations that have come up in terms of the State Department of Child Services and their ability not to provide adequate services. I believe the governor and myself and others are very passionate about this, and I've talked to him and his team about it. He has a private entity that's doing a deeper dive into the issues of the Department of Child Services. But I was able to get a resolution passed through the legislature that I'm asking for us to form a special committee of both the House and the Senate, our Children and Family Services Committee, to be ready over the next 2 years to address the issues that come out of this report and study that the governor's having being done. I think that legislators should be well-versed and informed about what's taking place. We are talking about the lives of children. And every day, we, as a state, we are able to impact the lives of children that are not in the best of conditions. They are not in the homes of a loving family, oftentimes, and they're there for a reason. So I think it is incumbent upon us to do everything that we can to make sure that the caseworkers, the supervisors, the providers to that agency have every single resource, every single tool available to them to address those needs of the children that we're talking about here. I think that's going to take some legislative action. I think it's going to take also a long-term approach on how do we ensure that we never arrive to a situation that we're in now wondering if we are doing the best job for children, but ensuring that we do the best job for these children.
Now, are we likely to see some requests coming forth here during this very special session coming up here about this?
Well, it was my hope that we could see that since we will have time mm-hmm. to address this in a special session, that since this is such an imperative issue, that it should be addressed. I'm not sure when the final report will be provided to the governor and his department and his team. However, we do know that there are certain things that we can do now. They're low-hanging fruit. The turnover of case managers, the training of case managers, and ensuring that they can stick around and provide the care and attention that it takes, not just for one child, but multiple children at the same time, I think is going to be very key and important that we show them that we respect their job and we want to support them every way that we can.
Senator Eddie Melton, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Indiana's black state legislators will hold a series of town halls around the state, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the events that are meant to provide an opportunity for constituents to meet face-to-face with their lawmakers.
This is the third year for the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus's town halls. Caucus Chair Cherish Pryor says the events help lawmakers tell constituents about the results of the legislative session and give citizens an opportunity to connect with their government.
We invite the mayors to come. We also want to make sure that the legislators in that area attend as well.
All the current members of the caucus are Democrats, but Pryor says they emphasize they want all interested constituents to attend.
The focus is not on being Democrat or Republican, it's providing the information to people.
The first town hall is in Indianapolis, with future meetings in East Chicago, South Bend, Fort Wayne, Terre Haute, and Evansville. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus's East Chicago Town Hall meeting will be held this Saturday, April 14th, beginning at noon, and it'll be at the St. Mark AME Zion Church on Alder Street in East Chicago. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Do you want to know what life is truly like for Hoosier children? Well, the information in the Indiana Youth Institute's 2018 Indiana Kids Count data book can help tell some stories, including those here in Northwest Indiana. And to find out more about the data book, let's turn now to Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you. Always glad to be with you, Chris.
Well, thank you very much. You're getting started. Tell us in general here what the Kids Count data book's about and what the information in general for the Hoosier State and, of course, in for Northwest Indiana has to show for this year.
Certainly. So IYI has been publishing this book for, it's our 24th year. So what it is the goal is really to measure overall child well-being at the local, state, and national levels, and really looking at the areas of health, education, economics, safety, and family. And so right now, Indiana ranks 28th overall for overall child well-being compared to the national level. So one of the things we did this year is we kind of wanted to step it up a little and go a little further with this data so there's more disaggregated data by race and ethnicity so that we can dig deeper at the county level and at the state level. So there were a couple of improvements, and then there are always areas that we need to give some more attention to, obviously.
If you will, tell us some of the major concerns. I know they had some good points and some bad points, I guess, as it seems like every single year the Kids Count book goes into those here, too. We've seen some improvements here, but then we seem to fall behind in some others. And I know one area in particular we're very concerned about is the opioid epidemic. But tell us first about a little bit of good news as far as statewide is concerned.
Certainly. So the good news is, first and foremost, that more of our kids than ever have access to health insurance. And so we know that that has a trickle-down effect as far as lots of different components and indicators for child well-being. So health insurance is great. More kids are covered than ever before. We also know that our teen pregnancy rates continue to fall and are at an all-time low. So that's very positive. And the third positive, I would say, is that for the first time since 2009, the child poverty rate fell to less than 20% statewide, 19.5%. Now, for Lake County, it's a little higher. It's at 25.7%. So Lake County's a little higher than the state level, but it's continuing to fall. And so that's what is a positive. We know that we still rank 31st in the nation for the number of children living in poverty.
Are we finding any different causes, or are they still the same basic causes for child poverty in Indiana?
You know, what we are finding is that obviously the employment rate right now is strong and the job demand is strong. However, for families with children, the ability to access those jobs is contingent upon available child care and transportation. And those two areas are still a challenge for our families with kids. You know, child care needs to be high quality, it needs to be available to all families, and it needs to be affordable. So sometimes there's not enough available, and sometimes when it is available, it is cost prohibitive for those families that are, looking to enter or re-enter the job market.
It is good to note, though, they mentioned about the fact that more children seem to be finding health insurance options here, and that's good because we've seen some pretty big changes. I know in some of the programs like MDYs and others that have basically gone out of business here in Indiana, so to speak, so they've been able to find suitable substitutes to help families out.
Yes, absolutely. And right now, statewide, over 92% of our kids have health insurance, which means they're going to hopefully get that preventative care, those vaccinations, those checkups, the dental checks, all of those things that can prevent some of those bigger long-term health consequences that disrupt education and all those kinds of things.
Now, I know that you mentioned one of the bad points that we've noted in the latest Kids Count book that has come out deals with the opioid epidemic. What are you finding in the various categories that this very serious problem is affecting everybody in the state and most particularly Indiana children?
It sure is. And I think oftentimes one of the things that we're trying to highlight is the fact that obviously talking about the adult users and addicts is very important. And there's lots of great work being done right now to try to talk about the appropriate interventions. But the reality is we're not talking a whole lot yet about what this means for kids. And what we found was that the number of cases of child neglect, now, you know, they lump them together, child abuse and neglect, but in reality, we know that as far as the opioid epidemic is concerned, what's happening is a lot of these kids are having, they're being acutely neglected. So because mom or dad are addicted, they're not providing appropriate housing, they're not providing appropriate food, health care. Maybe the kids aren't going to school on a regular basis. And we're seeing more and more of that really acute neglect impacting the kids as a result of the opioid crisis. And so what's happening is that there are more substantiated cases of neglect, and therefore there are more kids going into the protective care of the Department of Children's Services.
I was going to ask if the DCS is offering information that you're able to get, that you can find out how these particular cases are doing, and in turn, more and more cases of children ended up in custody or in at least supervision by the DCS.
Certainly. And I will say, the bright spot, I will say that Lake County is a little bit lower than the state average as far as the number of substantiated cases of abuse or neglect, and they do that on a ratio per 1,000 children. So Lake County is doing a little bit better than the state as a whole, but again, we've seen those increases. There's been a 58% increase in the number of children in foster care over the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. So when you think of that, that is just a tremendous number of kids that are not able to live at home anymore.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. The 2018 Kids Count data book is out this week, and we're finding out some of the particulars, in particular for Northwest Indiana. Tammy, let's continue on here, taking a look at the breakouts here in some of the areas that the book goes into more detail on. You mentioned here just about child abuse and neglect, how Lake County and surrounding counties are doing in that respect. How about for the child poverty issue?
Right. Again, for the first time since 2009, overall in the state, the child poverty rate fell to less than 20%. So that's a bright spot. It's right now at 19.5%. But Indiana still ranks 31st in the nation. So if you think, who wants to be 31st out of 50, right? That's significantly below the median. And the child poverty rate for Lake County is actually higher than the state rate. It's at 25.7%. And so, again, that's an indicator that we need to take a look at what is preventing those families, the parents and the families and the caregivers and the families from, getting the jobs and having a living wage so that they can adequately take care of the kids.
Do you think that maybe over time that's going to improve, especially here in Lake County and surrounding counties, as the economy is certainly strong and we find the overall Indiana unemployment rate is down, but we still have efforts to try and find decent jobs for a lot of people in the state?
Absolutely. And I think what we're going to find is that the jobs are going to be there. You know, we work a lot with the Department of Workforce Development, and there are right now there's a good number of great jobs, particularly in manufacturing and in those kinds of sectors, and there will continue to be a demand there. What we're going to have to talk about is how do we make sure that we're matching the people can get to those jobs? How mm-hmm. do we make sure that transportation's available? And like we said, for families with kids, particularly little kids, that aren't school age yet, how do we make sure that there's sufficient amount of quality care available?
Let's talk about education now. How do the figures look in the book and how they seem to correspond here to Lake County and vicinity?
Sure. Well, you know, when we look at the two big indicators that we look at is proficiency levels for reading for fourth graders and math for eighth graders. And again, Indiana is doing better than the national average, and yet that better than the national average is still something that I think most of us would agree isn't quite where we want it to be, that right about 40% of our kids are proficient in reading and math. And 40%, if you went to a classroom right now and said 40% of you are going to be okay on reading and math and the other 60% are not, are going to be struggling, I don't think as parents and community members we're quite ready to go with that yet, right? That's something we would, I think, all say collectively. We're not okay with just 40% of our kids being proficient in those two areas.
Okay. Now, taking a look here, and you mentioned some of this earlier at the outset of our conversation here about child mortality, and and Indiana is still ranking like that's near the bottom of the number of states overall, but Lake County is in particularly high for here. Tell us about the situation here.
Certainly, and I think most of us probably got a glimmer of this in the governor's State of the State address, that he highlighted the fact that Indiana currently ranks 41st in the nation on infant mortality. And there's a ton of factors that go into that infant mortality. It's access to prenatal care, access to quality nutrition, and those kinds of things. And so infant mortality has long been one of those indicators that kind of just talks about general health. And so unfortunately, that 41st ranking is not where we'd want it to be. And so in Indiana, infants are, this is a big stat, and I think this continues to grab it every time we hear it. Indiana infants are 24% more likely to die before their first birthday than the national average.
Wow. That's not that good news there, to be sure. So we find that out, to be sure. Now, from the information that we get from the Kids Count data book every year, what information is something that community organizations, community governments, and others can take advantage of to try to make things better?
Absolutely. And thank you, Chris, for highlighting that, because actually the whole goal of all of this, of all the data that we put out there, is to have those conversations in your community, to take a look and to analyze what are those indicators that we as a community, it may be as the community, it may be as a school district, it may be as a church community, that we want to work on. And so all of the information is available free of charge on IYI.org if you just go to our data center. And it's the whole entire data book is there, but you can also break it down and type in your county that you're in and get a county snapshot. And then you can even compare it to some of the surrounding counties. So again, part of those conversations are maybe Lake County right now, really the infant mortality rate is particularly high, but maybe there's a county next to yours or maybe one similar in the state that seems to have better outcomes. So starting some of those conversations of saying, what are they doing there and how might we be able to replicate that here at home so that, again, we can better ensure that all of our kids grow up and that they're healthy and safe and well-educated.
Well, it certainly sounds like what you say is a good place for conversations to start if they haven't already, or at least to pick back up again as we start a new year here in 2018. We've been talking with Tammy Silverman, the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. They've just put out the 2018 Kids Count data book, and it's broken down by county. So if you go to the IYI.org website, take a look at the information, and you can find out the individual breakouts per county as well, too. It'll get you started on some of the important conversations. And as always, Tammy, thank you very much for being with us and sharing the information with us today.
Always my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
You know, whether you're captivated by rustic log cabins, or if you love Victorian-era houses, or if you're mad for mid-century modern, well, you'll want to check out this year's Logs de Lustrans Tour. It's going to be held, of course, at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore here in Northwest Indiana. You'll certainly find something that will interest you, and in particular, you want to attend an event that happens the evening before the tour itself. And to find out all about it, let's check in with Todd Zeiger. He's the director of the Northern Regional Office of Indiana Landmarks. Todd, welcome to the show.
Hey, greetings, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Well, first, give us a little history background here about the tour itself and why the tour seems to be so popular when it comes up every May.
This is a great opportunity for folks to explore their nearby national park. The fascinating part about this tour is that within one day or as part of the talk the night before, you can experience over 100 years of architecture pretty much in order, 1850 to past the 1950s. So it's just an amazing opportunity right nearby where folks live to experience that very wide range from a log structure such as the Irene Nelson House to something more mid-century like a Lustron or the Meyer House. And we're just really excited. Indiana Landmarks and the National Park and the Dunes National Park Association are partnering up to do this tour, and we're just really, really excited for about a month from now to welcome everybody over.
Now, the tour is going to actually be on May 5th, and that's the day that you want to make note of, that you get a chance to check out these great structures. But the evening before, at 7 o'clock on May 4th, there's going to be a very special illustrated talk. The title of the talk is Logs, Glass, and Metal, A Century of Architectural Legacy. Tell us who's involved with that talk, where it's going to be, and why it certainly is very key to how the tour goes.
The topic and the title really lays it out. It just helps folks get this broad range overview of what is within the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, certainly known for its natural environment and wonderful areas and walking in the paths. There's this legacy of logs and glass and all kinds of architecture. So this talk is meant to illustrate that for folks and be able to get that in an hour and a half time frame. Myself, I'll give part of the presentation about it. Cliff Goins with the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore will be involved. Then also, we're adding this year, and each year moving forward, one of the folks that have done work to restore one of the homes as part of the leasing program. And so this year, it's the Schmansky family who have been our partners in restoring the Irene and Oscar Nelson House on US 12. It's that little yellow cottage that if you've driven down 12, you might have noticed. It's part of our leasing program. So they're going to be part of the talk this year to tell their story about restoring the house and what they found and the challenges of restoring a log and later structures. So that's really exciting. This talk on Friday night, the night before May 4th, is at the Portage Park Pavilion right on the lakeshore, and talk about glass and steel, fantastic venue for this.
Now, do you have to have reservations or tickets or something like that to attend the talk?
Yes, we really do ask for that. The talk is limited in number, as are the tickets for the tour themselves. So, and that is pretty easy to find. If folks want to go to our webpage, indianalandmarks.org, and navigate over to the calendar section, you can find the reservation for both the lecture on Friday night and the tour on Saturday, which there are lots of different time slots you can take the tour on.
We're talking with Todd Zeiger, who is Northern Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks, about the special talk on May 4th, learning about the legacy of architecture in Northwest Indiana, in particular the talk that leads up to the May 5th Logs to Lustrons tour that is happening in the region, how the architecture varies from the 19th century into the 20th century. Tell us about what the Swedish influence is on the region and the landmarks that they have left behind, and then get us into the 20th century and tell us more about the Lustrons.
The fascinating part about the Swedish heritage, you can see it very much so in these log structures. It's how they were assembled and put together, the types of corners they would build, and those nuances of those log structures are fascinating. And so when you get inside these houses as part of the tour, some of the walls are exposed. You can actually see these log structures and understand how they were built through the Swedish environment. And it's just a really fascinating look at how buildings were constructed in the mid-19th century. And then as you go through this tour, and also we'll kind of demonstrate through photographs in some limited fashion of the talk as well, as we move into the turn of the century, you can see how houses were added onto, and so the structure changes and the exteriors change. So you'll see that as you visit the Field Station Cooperative site or perhaps maybe one of the other properties owned by the park that's opened as part of this. So you can kind of see how houses change as you're going through this tour in kind of order. And as you move into the 1950s, one of my favorite interesting children is the Lustron houses, these all-metal homes brought to the site on the truck in 3,000 pieces and assembled like a big erector set. And just a fascinating comparison if you think about starting the day in a log structure and going through these all-metal structures and be able to compare the differences in those two. And then the Meyer House, which is certainly more, I guess, a modern style, lots of glass and open. Be able to see how that changed. Really, within 100 years, how different these houses looked from solid log structures with smaller windows to a Meyer House with this almost all glass. It's just a fascinating opportunity within an hour and a half tour to be able to live through that century, century and a half of architecture. Mm-hmm.
I noticed you mentioned this year that you're going to have an opportunity to put the Goodfellow Lodge up for display, which is, I guess, is a new feature within the Logs to Lustrance tour. Tell us about the lodge and how it ties together with the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Park itself.
Those folks who live nearby are probably familiar with the old lodge and sits there at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. And it's not been open for public tour in the past, and so we're just excited to offer this opportunity to see inside what you would maybe call a traditional summer camp experience building. If you just think about what you would think a lodge looks like and you go inside, it very much is. Lots of wood and a little balcony and, you know, large open space for folks that the kids that used to go there as a part of the U.S. Steel summer camp. There. And so we're just excited to open this up. We think people are going to be very interested to see inside this building. It's owned by the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and it doesn't currently have a use. And we think it's a great opportunity for folks to see inside of the building that they've not been able to see before, and offering that for the first time. And that's part of what we're excited about this year, adding that building in.
And we talked, too, of course, about the Lustrans and that type of construction of houses back in the 20th century. In fact, my very first house I actually owned was a National Homes Corporation construction house. And although you wouldn't think that it would have metal walls inside the house, it did. Because I used to have to take a drill to be able to put up a picture. Instead of using a hammer and nail or some type of fastener, I'd have to actually drill a hole and put a screw in to be able to hang a photograph or a painting or something like that, because that was what they used at that time in constructing those prefab houses back then. So it's interesting to hear about these Lustran homes and find that the concept is certainly not dead, to be sure.
The fascinating thing about the Lustran houses, of course, they all the metal walls, and so you would use magnets to hang up your pictures and whatnot during the time frame. It's a fascinating building system, and National Homes and others, the kit houses of the time, trying to meet that post-World War II housing. The folks being able to take a look on the inside of those is a really kind of fun opportunity for sure.
Yeah. And we talk here about wanting to take advantage of the Logs to Lustrance tour, once again this year, offered by the Indiana Landmarks. If you will, Todd, fill us in on the details on how you can get the tickets to be able to attend the tour, and what youngsters will have a chance to do, too, if they happen to come along as a family event.
We will be driving through the Century of Progress District, and we'll talk about that and give some people some overview where those homes are not open. That's a separate tour, which this year is going to be held September 29th. So if folks want to mark their calendar for that, it's moving up this year. So we'll talk about the COP houses, but aren't going in any of those as part of the Logs to Lustrans tour. That's a separate tour. To get tickets for this and the lecture as well as the tour, navigate to the calendar section of our webpage, which is indianalandmarks.org, and you can find both the tickets to reserve for the talk as well as pick a time frame. There's different slots you can pick to take the tour on Saturday, so it fits within your schedule. Tour start in the morning at 8:30, and they go through 2 o'clock. And it's really an opportunity. It's kind of like an open house. You can take a shuttle. You have to take the shuttle, and you can go to these different sites and make your way through. So indianalandmarks.org, and just go to the calendar section and look for Logs to Lustrans. Tickets are limited for both the talk and the tour, so if you're interested, I would just encourage you to get online sooner than later. We sold out last year, and expect a similar situation this year.
So. Well, certainly. You want to check that out if you haven't done so before. It's certainly worth the time to make the trek up to the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore from wherever you happen to be to check out not only the May 4th Logs, Glass, and Metal of Century of Architectural Legacy talk that happens the evening before, and then, of course, on May 5th, is the actual tour itself, leaving from locations. And you'll find out more about that when you check out the Indiana Landmarks website, too. Todd Zeiger is the Northern Indiana Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks. His office is based over in South Bend, and we appreciate you taking time to talk with us today, Todd, about the upcoming tour, and hope, once again, that it's a sold-out tour, so get your tickets now for either the talk or the tour itself. It's worth the trek up that way, and thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Indiana Farm Bureau says if China follows through on its threat to slap U.S. soybeans with a 25% tariff, it could put some farmers out of business. Barbara Brozier reports that announcement came as farmers nationwide were expected to plant more soybeans than corn for the first time in more than 2 decades.
David Hardin is a third-generation farmer in rural Hendricks County. We're walking along a field on his property when he points to a series of large rectangular buildings.
There's actually four buildings back there, and each one of them has around 1,500 animals.
Inside are hogs, which Hardin primarily sells in the Midwest. Some of them go to a processing facility that exports pork to other countries. As far as Hardin knows, none of his pork goes to China, so it won't be hit with a new 25% tariff. But he says that doesn't matter.
If there's more pork on the market domestically because it's not moving to China, it's going to lower prices for all U.S. producers, whether they play in the export space or not.
Farmers are used to coping with the unknown. Much of their job depends on factors outside of their control, like the weather. Hardin says that's what makes these tariffs difficult to accept. He sees it as something the U.S. government can control. China put tariffs on some U.S. imports to retaliate against President Donald Trump's decision to slap tariffs on imported steel and aluminum.
We've seen, such a large drop in pork prices. It equates to about a $3,000 per week drop in our income here on our farm.
Hardin's farm is one of more than 3,000 family-owned pig farms in Indiana. And they aren't the only ones who could see losses because of tariffs. China is now threatening to put a 25% tariff on more U.S. products, including soybeans. Nearly two-thirds of the soybeans grown in the U.S. go to China. A recent Purdue University study looks at two different scenarios and what they would mean for the U.S. Wally Tyner is an agricultural economics professor at Purdue University and one of the study's authors. During a Skype interview, he says no matter the size of the tariff, applying one to U.S. soybeans would have a significant impact.
For the 10% tariff, our estimate is, and we did a lot of sensitivity on it, but the average estimate was that exports to China would fall 33%. And with 30% tariff, 71%.
The threat of tariffs on U.S. soybeans is coming when farmers are on pace to plant more soybeans than corn for the first time in more than two decades. The USDA says the largest increase will be in Indiana, where farmers will plant more than 6 million acres of soybeans this year. Robert White is the director of national government relations for the Indiana Farm Bureau. He says, frankly, the timing couldn't be worse.
Because we're in a down economy for agriculture, and we're about 50% lower than we were in ag income about 4 years ago.
White says it could be enough to put some people out of business. But it's all up in the air right now. And Hardin says that uncertainty makes it even worse. He says the futures price for pork is already declining all the way into some of his 2019 contracts. And on top of that, Hardin is paying more to replace equipment around the farm.
Many of the products, like replacement gates and flooring that we use on the farm, are made out of steel. Any new tractors obviously have steel as a component. So if the price of any of the products that we buy that are made out of steel go up, we're getting hurt kind of on both ends of the equation.
He's trying to cut back where he can, but it's hard when he has hogs to feed and workers to pay. In Hardin's eyes, there's no winner in this potential trade war. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
And it's time now for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Sam Love, president of the Calumet Artist Residency, which is located in Miller, right, Sam?
Yeah, that's correct. Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How long has Calumet Artist Residency been around?
Well, Calumet Artist Residency was formed in 2012 by Corey Hagelberg and Kate Land. I came in about a year later when they wanted to have community-based programming. Like a typical artist residency, we were bringing artists in from around the world to come to Gary and do work. We're at the connection of arts and nature. But we wanted to branch out more and do work in the community. And that was my background. I've got about 15 years of both education and social practice in Chicago. I was born in Merrillville, but I went to Chicago for a little while and decided to come back home in 2012. And then in 2016, we became a 501c3 nonprofit, which allowed us to start getting grant money. And we did the Gary Poetry Project last year, which I think you have a question about, and I'll say a little bit about.
Then I won't. Shall we talk about the Gary Poetry Project?
Sure. Let's
now?
Jump to that.
I think that sounds like a good time.
I had so much fun doing it. I want to keep talking about it forever.
Well,
so
go ahead. Feel free.
Well, thanks to the Knight Fund at the Legacy Foundation, as well as Art House, Indiana University Northwest, and Kids Stuff Play Systems, we had support to do a year-long poetry writing project in Gary. Mm-hmm. We had money to hire young adults to lead poetry writing workshops. Mm-hmm. And what we would do is we'd collect a line from every participant and combine those together into one long big city poem, which we began to paint on buildings in Gary. Mm-hmm. We collected 1,100 lines mm-hmm. in a city of about 77,000 people. We held 67 workshops and events last year. Mm-hmm. So yes, more than one a week. And they were all wonderful. I can say that completely. Every one of them had just something different and special about it. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have some more public art coming up this year. You know, April is National Poetry Month, so we didn't want to just do this year-long poetry project and then never mm-hmm. touch that again. Mm-hmm. We want to bring that as part of our repertoire. Mm-hmm. So late March, early April, we are going to wheat paste the entire poem, 1,100 lines, on the backside of our two-story building in Miller near Lake Street. So
that's
this
fantastic.
Is going to be about a 19-foot-tall poem.
You know, South Shore Arts, which I work for, we're going to be doing a big exhibit on public art and the documentation of public art projects like yours. And Ish Muhammad is going to be curating that show. So I think that your project is something that we're going to want him to include in the exhibit.
Oh, I would love to see Ish all the time. He's a
fantastic.
Great guy.
So what is this zine thing you're doing? Tell me about that.
Oh, sure. So, for those that don't know, a zine is an informal publication, usually a very personal one. Mm-hmm. It dates back to I always say zine started in the 70s with punk rock and the availability of uh-huh. cheap Xerox. Uh-huh. And so it was a way of making your own publication. Well, with the internet and blogs, they said it was going to disappear and print was going to die. But would you believe it? Zines are more popular now than ever. So the Lubeznik Center in Michigan City brought us on to do this small press fair and some workshops as well as panels. And that's going to be on the 21st of April mm-hmm. in Michigan City. So you can either go to the Lubeznik Center website mm-hmm. or CalumetResidency.com. And find information about that. But it's going to be a full day. They'll have local publications for sale. There'll be a great crowd of people, art displays, and things for children as well.
So who's doing all these things? You're do you have a paid staff?
A lot of it's volunteer from us, but our foundation money does allow us to tie it into these projects that
so
we're doing.
So you hire instructors to help
yes.
kind of moderate the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And are you run your organization is run by a small board, I take it?
As of today, we're going to be adding two new board members, which I'm really happy to say. So, yeah, we have a board of seven mm-hmm. and then a pool of volunteers who have kind of – joined around us.
And
we're happy to have
are
them.
You all artists of some sort, one way or another?
I would say so. Maybe mm-hmm. some more than others. You know, Corey is a trained practicing sure. artist. Mm-hmm. I feel like I fell into the arts when I was in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I have things that I do, photography, writing, stuff like that. But we also have performers. We have very excited to introduce a young woman, Crystal Wilson, who is one of our main teaching poets. She's, I think, 22, 23 years old. So mm-hmm. she's going to join us older groups in this. So we're an intergenerational group as well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of really interesting work.
Thank you.
And a very grassroots.
Very
grassroots level. Yeah, it's great. And we didn't talk about the Nature Project. And we don't have time either.
Okay.
So we'll have to have you back.
Some other time.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. Well, Sam, that was great. Thank you for being here to tell us about your activities.
Thanks, John. Good to see you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
As John Kane talking with Sam Love of the Zine and Small Press Fest. If you missed a conversation, you can also catch it online at our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and go to the Eye on the Arts section. And tune in next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for the program for today. Thanks for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow with the conversations, among others, with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer.